If you are a military family and you are finding yourself moving often, or if you are friends with military families and you know that you have to have those hard goodbyes, or even if you are a professional supporting families that are moving, you want to hang tight and listen to Meg Flanagan. She is talking about military kids. How can we support them, especially when they have an IEP? How do we educate and inform the teachers that are receiving them during a move? How do we better support them with their hidden trauma and making sure that we're doing right by our families? Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. If you are a new parent to special education or a seasoned parent sitting at the IEP table, welcome and join us today talking to Meg Flanagan. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. I am a mom and special educator. I have sat on both sides of the IEP table as a parent and a professional. Over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build killer IEPs and support plans. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you're new to our podcast, give us a like, a follow, and a review. Also, you know your kids best. You know if they're struggling or thriving, if they are happy or losing hope, if they understand or are completely lost. The question is, what now? If you're unsure what step to take to help your child succeed and need a starting point, take my free quiz, learningessentialsedu.com. Answer some simple questions about your child. It will guide you towards the first step in helping your child be the best they can be. Welcome to the show. I am excited to chat with Meg today. We are talking about military families and specifically IEPs and finding your voice and incredibly important and powerful stuff we are going to discuss. So I'm excited that you can join us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. Meg, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you came to be a supportive advocate for our students with IEPs and military students with IEPs?
Absolutely. So I'm a teacher by trade and by passion. I love teaching. I love learning. I love engaging with students. However, when I was first licensed back in 2010, there weren't a lot of jobs where I was living in California. My husband is active duty military. And so I looked around and said, well, gosh, I have a lot of families here who are needing tutors for their child, but they can't afford to pay the market rate in Southern California, which is a very wealthy population in many areas. And so I started offering tutoring services to children, and I have a degree in special ed. I'm certified in special ed. And so I ended up just having a wide base of children with a lot of different learning disabilities in my practice. And so that kind of naturally led to parents asking me, well, can you give me some insight or write up an anecdotal report? And then through the process of several moves going in and out of the classroom, I realized that military families have a struggle with special education and 504 plans, and even gifted education, really anything that's outside of the typical like lane of education, anything that's divergent at all is very challenging because every state has different laws. And so I again looked around and said, well, I have a master's in special education. I move all the time with a military spouse. Well, let me raise my hand and I will start a small business to provide some insights at a price that is reasonable, but still on par with the market range. Because I want to make sure that we're accessible, that I'm accessible to military families, but also to honor the fact that this is a professional job. And it's just kind of naturally evolved from there into a thriving practice.
I love that. I love that. That is fantastic. Can you give us a big picture view on advocacy?
Yes. So there's a couple of different, when you talk about advocacy, there's a couple of different ways the word can be used. So the way that I use it is a very personal, individual-based, one family at a time role. I take on a case, I take on a client, I deep dive their paperwork, and then I show up at the meetings and provide professional insights into what might be happening and help bridge the gap between home and school to make sure that that one child has the education plan that fits them best. The other definition of advocacy is on the legislative and policy side, where you are going to state governing bodies, federal governing bodies, and really pushing for policy and legal changes. That is not the kind of advocacy that I practice, although I fully support it. And I have connections with several military organizations that are pushing for changes for military kids with disabilities. I don't really handle the legislative side.
And I love that you have this unique perspective because you have the training and special education. You've moved around as a family. And so you kind of understand what that feels like for families. What are some common barriers you see that military families face that have students with challenges?
Absolutely. So this is really for any highly mobile family. So any family, whether it's due to being unhoused or State Department, military, anyone that works for the federal government can be moved between offices usually. But one of the things that is most common is figuring out how to request evaluations for your child and so that they are both timely and able to be completed before you move. So if you're thinking about anyone that's familiar with public education knows, especially for kiddos that do have challenges or are not succeeding on par with their typically developing peers, you know, you usually kind of look at it and you take some data and then you might do an intervention. And then that might take 6 to 8 weeks. And then if that doesn't work, you might try a different one. At which point, you know, even if this is starting in, say, November, at this point, we're already like well into March, April timeframe. And then it's the end of the school year. And if that child is moving, when they get to their new school, they're starting the process fresh with brand new eyes on everything. And so it's going to take a full quarter till that first progress report for the school to once again take action. So a lot of this is about timing it out for military families and providing that document trail of, at school A, my child was getting interventions in X and Y. They were unsuccessful. And so now I'm at school B. How do I document this in a way that's meaningful so that school B is spurred to take action earlier? And so if you're not getting assessed until this time frame, by the time those assessments are done, there's not enough time necessarily to evaluate them, do eligibility, create a plan, move forward, implement the plan. Like it's a timing issue. And that goes for, you know, children with 504s, IEPs, and gifted education, which gifted education is honestly, because 504s and IEPs are protected by federal law, I don't want to say easier, but there's more recognition when you're moving between public schools in different states and locations. But because gifted education is not federally protected and every state implements it differently, some states have gifted IEPs, some states don't have gifted IEPs, and every school, every district implements gifted programs differently if they have them at all. There's no national standard. It makes it more challenging to move with a gifted child.
Wow. And, you know, I'm thinking just for a family that is in one place, you're absolutely right. You know, the timing is essential. And I think it's even challenging for folks that are in one place to really understand that scope of timing. So could you share with us, for folks that are listening that have a struggling student at home and they are wanting to start that process, whether they are a military family or a family in place, what is your recommendation? So can we just kind of give like a bird's eye view of that timeline to put this all into perspective? And then I want to wrap it back to how do we help families that are moving consistently time this out?
Absolutely. So usually, if you have any concerns about your child at all, what you're looking for are the blips in their grades. So when I'm considering, and I have school-age children, so I'll talk about my kids as an example. So if I'm looking at my child's report card or even their work samples coming home, and I'm noticing, okay, we're in the zone, A's and B's, amazing, amazing. And all of a sudden there's a D in there. There's something that is outside of the norm. That raises a red flag for me. And so I document it. And it might just be like a note on my phone or an email to my spouse, an email to the teacher, just so I have something documenting it with a timestamp of, hey, I noticed that, you know, multiplication in the 12th table was really challenging. Can, you know, November 11th, can you talk to me about what this looks like? then you're looking for a pattern of blips. So let's say that it starts in November with, you know, multiplication being a blip in math, and then it continues, there continues to be that downward trajectory or trend in grades. That's when all of my senses kind of go on high alert. And I am emailing the teacher and saying, what can you tell me about math? And I'm just using math as an example. It could be any subject. What could you tell me about this? So it starts with the communication to the teacher. If they have an explanation of like, well, we're doing small groups and, you know, I'm shortening their work and we're reteaching and, you know, I'm implementing IXL or Khan Academy and, you know, they're getting pulled twice a week with the math specialist. That tells me that they're doing a lot of interventions for my child and they're still not succeeding. The first step, and this is an important right for parents, any parent in American education, public education to know about, is that your child has a right to something called Child Find, where the local education agency, your public school district, wherever you are located, has the requirement to locate any child that has a disability, a diagnosed disability, or any child that is suspected of having a disability that impacts their education and test them. And the way that you, mom and dad, grown-ups at home can initiate this is with a written email or a letter sent to the principal of your child's school, or if you are a homeschooler or a private school family, you can also access this by just sending it to your child's local school, whatever school you would go to if they went to public school. Send it in and say, I would like my child tested for X because, and you list out the reasons why. There's a consistent pattern of low grades. They're struggling. The teacher has already tried all of these interventions. Something else is going on. So the timeline from there does vary by state, but within usually 1 to 3 school weeks, the school does have to come back to you and either say, yes, we're going to test, or no, we're not going to test. If they say no, you can appeal it in many cases and submit again with stronger evidence or more insights into supporting it. There's no limit to how many times you can request your child to be tested. And eventually, sometimes it's the, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. If you make yourself of enough of a nuisance and kind of not nuisance, but like you speak up enough, the school district takes notice, is like, well, we're just going to test to check in the box. We tested. Great, great, great. So if they say yes, then they will obtain your consent, which means you just have to sign and say, yeah, I consent that they're going to test. They'll tell you what testing they're going to do. The testing usually has to be done within about 2 months, usually 60. It's either school days, business days, or calendar days, but usually it's somewhere in like the 60s range. After they're done testing, they'll share the results with you, hopefully beforehand. They have to have a meeting to review the results, determine eligibility at that meeting based on the results, and then you move to the IEP meeting. So the whole process can take upwards of 4 calendar months. We do the math, we're already in February.
And I'm glad you said that. And I'm glad we just kind of set the stage for folks that are listening, because that's upwards of 4 calendar months of just the process. That's not writing the letter. That's not documenting. And I like that you use the word stronger evidence. And I tell my families as well, the more specifics you can provide that outline, what has been done, what type of support, how is this different from the same age peers, anything, like you said, you email a timestamp, whether it's an email to a spouse or something on your phone. So you kind of have to be that super sleuth prior to, so that you can have the evidence to build your case, which can be hard, right? Because that's your baby that you're talking about. And if you're not in a profession where you're around other kids, it's also hard to know what is same age and what is not.
100%. Yeah, it is. It is tricky if you're not working in a child focused field, or you're not keenly aware of developmental milestones and learning milestones. It is very hard to know what is normal or what is typical and what is atypical on both ends of the spectrum, right? So whether it's a child that is significantly behind or a child that is significantly ahead, it's hard.
So how do you help the families that are having to move, right? So they've kind of know something's coming, but then, all right, well, we're moving. So how do you navigate that?
It can be very tricky. A lot of the families that I work with already have a plan in place, and it's really more about refining the plan. However, a lot of the families that follow me on social media or on my website are in the beginning stage process of, you know, trying to figure out what is going on. So what happens is, I actually have several blogs about it, but like what to look for at school if you have a concern. And usually parents who are tracking their child at school already, so you're already highly involved. You're already the mom or dad or, you know, custodial, you know, aunt, uncle, grandma, grandpa, whichever grown-up is at home, is already on Blackboard or Schoology or Canvas or whatever the learning app is that they're using, checking grades, emailing teachers. You're already a parent or a guardian that is involved. So the first step to figuring out what your child needs is to just be involved. Just make sure that you know who the child's teacher is. Make sure that you kind of have a general sense about how they are. The next step is to step up the involvement and attend parent-teacher conferences all of the time. So my kids are fairly typically developing. There's not a lot of red flags for them. But even with that being said, I always attend a parent-teacher conference. Even though I'm a teacher, even though I can look at them and kind of do my assessment of their progress based on the work samples I see at home, I still like to talk to the teacher because it's a different perspective than me, mom, sitting at home with them. Because kids behave differently at school and with different grownups. So you want to have that secondary and tertiary insight into your child from someone else. The next thing that you're probably going to want to do is you're going to want to check in on their schoolwork. Look at those work samples as they're coming home. Look for, and the things that you look for are different based on the ages. So in the early years, it's a lot of language arts focus. Are they writing with, and can you determine what they're writing? Right. If they're writing, look, do you see a l, a k? Do you see those sounds in the word? Math, are they able to look at the array of objects and count them up? And so you really do have to kind of inspect your child's homework like a spy. Look for these clues, these little red flags. If something seems off, ask for it, ask about it. One of my kids consistently flips their letters, B's and D's, P's and Q's. And so that's on my radar all of the time because it's going to no longer be developmentally appropriate at a very, very quickly approaching deadline. So it's really just about being involved and looking. What looks weird to you? What looks different than what you remember at that age? And then asking, is this okay? Is this normal?
What type of supports do families require if they have children living with or children that are neurotypical?
So children that are neurotypical, I would say just the general supports means they need caring adults in their lives, someone to talk to that's not the grownups that live at their house. So access to, you know, a school counselor or a trusted teacher or even a friend's grownups. That's wonderful if they can have another grown-up to talk to, you know, a good pediatrician, a dentist, and then, you know, someone who cares, someone who's looking.
And then how about our neurodivergent friends?
Ooh, our neurodivergent friends need all those same things.
Yes.
But also they need more of a, they need a more robust backfield in terms of medical and mental health support. So depending on the differences, the diagnosis, they might need occupational therapists, physical therapists, speech and language therapists, and applied behavior analysis analyst. They might need neurologists, psychiatrists, a neuropsych, a psychologist. You pick a medical profession and they might, someone who is neurodiverse or physically different might need someone in that field.
So how do we help bridge that gap of system and support for families that are moving? Because that's what you just listed, a lot of professions. And if I'm moving, I mean, gosh, if I'm moving even from zip code, you think, all right, how do you find somebody? How does that carry, you know, how do we bridge that gap if we have a student in a school that's changing schools with an IEP and requires a variety of folks on their team for the support they need to be successful?
So it definitely requires a lot of coordination. The military has a couple of structures in place called the Exceptional Family Member Program. Spouses, so dependents, they lump us all into the category of dependents, whether you're married to the active duty, whether you're married to the military member, or you're the child of a military member, you're just called a dependent. So everyone that's a dependent is required to register for Exceptional Family Program, EFMP, when they receive their diagnosis. And it could be for any diagnosis, right? So mental health, dyslexia, dyspraxia, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, autism, ADHD, a diagnosis that requires specialized medical care, or even medical care that's outside of general medicine. Like if you need more than just an annual checkup, you're in EFMP at this point. And so this service is supposed to, keyword supposed to, screen family members as they're moving to ensure that there is a medical match. So if I need a heart specialist, I'm not supposed to be sent to certain places because there's no specialty cardiology available. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Supposed to. So now the other issue is that while they're supposed to do this in practice, it doesn't always translate into the real world in a meaningful way. So a lot of times, or sometimes I should say, not a lot of times, sometimes families are sent places where there are not medical specialists or an educational program in place to support their children. So with kids that just need, that just have IEPs, it's a little bit, and you're staying stateside, you're staying in the continental United States, it's a little bit easier because at this point, every public school has some level of ability to serve children who learn differently, right? Every school has special education, not just some schools, it's every school. Where it gets trickier is when you're dealing with children that are already outplaced or have a private placement in their current home district, and now they're moving, and now how do you transfer that private placement to a new school? So I think we're both in like the Maryland, the DMV region. So if your child is at Kennedy Krieger or, you know, Johns Hopkins in the gifted program, how do you translate that when you're moving to Nebraska?
How do you?
I don't know. or if they're placed at the Auburn school, you know, on a school district paid placement to a specialty special education school, and they're moving to California, what are the legal requirements? And that's tricky ground because IEPs do transfer, but then,
right? Because you have a federal document, but now you're transferring from one school system to another. So do they have a place that is equal or greater to what you're already in? Correct. And how do you determine what that is that aligns with free and appropriate education? And how do we talk to that school district to ensure they understand the necessity of a specialized placement?
Correct. And that is the tricky part, because every school district does special education a little differently, because every state's special education laws are written just a little bit differently. So I'll go back to an earlier example of, I said school days, business days, or calendar days. Every single state has the right to set their own timelines in order to determine the speed of processing. So in Virginia, I want to say it's 10 business days that they have to respond to that initial IEP testing request. Now in Maine, it's 15 school days, if I read the law correctly. In Florida, parents can make a request, but the school has to prove that they've done RTI first before they can process that evaluation, which is, I think, the silliest thing in the world, but that's a different story. And so how do you communicate all of these different needs? To further complicate that, every school district has some special policies when it comes to where do I place children? So Fairfax County, for example, seems to have a written or unwritten, I've never seen documented proof of this, I'm waiting, where they will only give students with a medical need a one-to-one aid, even if that child is an elopement risk, even if that child has a one-to-one aid written into their program, into their IEP that they're bringing in, because the federal law says that a receiving school district has to provide only comparable services, and they have, it's either 30 days or 45 days, depending on where you live, to look at the IEP and suggest or recommend additional evaluations. They get to do their own evaluations to determine eligibility, placement, and services after moving. And so you could walk in with a really great IEP that you have worked really hard to build for 3 years in Georgia, and you go to a school system in a different state, and they get to retest your child and decide if your child remains eligible for special education.
So how do we guide and support parents to kind of make this a little transition a little bit smoother? It's already incredibly stressful when you're moving and you're forming new friendships and connections. And like we just said earlier, in terms of finding a physician that will best support your child or service provider to support your personal, your own child. And then now you have this other layer of, you feel like you're on this heightened fight or flight to get the support your child needs.
Yeah, there's, so the way I work, so hiring an advocate is definitely one way that you can support this. Unfortunately, not everyone is able to afford or locate an advocate that is well-versed in military family needs. So when you are, if you are a highly mobile family, it's super important to research where you are going and then reach out to school districts and say, this is my child. This is their IEP. This is what their services look like here in location A. What do children with this type of learner profile look like in your district? What do you offer them? If your district cannot serve them, do you know of a district or private placement that can serve them? And so the private placement option, I think, is super important. Because when we're considering public education, it all comes down to funding streams. And I hate that it's that way, but not every district has a depth of funding in order to support a huge diversity of options. We're also facing a national special education teacher shortage. People are leaving the field. And so being able to find a teacher that is well-versed in your child's specific diagnosis is kind of hit or miss.
This sounds so stressful.
Super stressful. It's very stressful with neurotypical children too.
Yeah. Yeah. What is the best direction that you would give for parents during a move in terms of finding, I think, finding an advocate, whether it's just a consultation for an hour, if you could do that to kind of be versed into what is available in that area, what are the laws in the area where you're moving, and what does that look like?
Absolutely. So for military families, you'll get like a couple weeks perhaps, or up to 6 or more months lead time into where you're going next. So I know when we moved from Japan to the DC region, we had about 3 months of prep time, of lead time before we left Japan. And so I was able to do a deep dive into the area and look at all the different school districts. Now for families that are perhaps not teachers, every military family has what's called a school liaison officer or a SLO at every single duty station or base. And so you should reach out to the school liaison officer at your next duty station and say, could you tell me which school districts are in this area? And that will give you the starting point. They also should have a list of public schools, private schools, charter schools, all of the different school options. They cannot tell you which school option is best for your child. They can only tell you the information of what is out there. Once you have the information of what is out there, then you have to kind of do your own family juggling act of what do you value more? Commute, housing price, school, especially in the DC, Maryland, Virginia area where commute time is long, housing is at a premium, and it's expensive. So you kind of have to do your own juggling act. Everywhere is different. So North Carolina, what you're looking for will be different than what you're looking for in DC, then Virginia, then Maryland, then Nebraska, then California, then Massachusetts. Pick a place and it will look different what you are looking for. Once you have the information of what's available, then I would go to every school should have what's called a school report card website. And it literally just tells you how a district, a town, so Fairfax County and a lot of other places have small towns within a larger system. It's like Loudoun is different. There's like Loudoun County, and then Vienna is a town, but it's inside of Fairfax County. It can be very confusing and it can be a lot. And of course, every state is organized differently. So knowing where you're going, and then look at the school report card website and kind of look and see, okay, what am I looking for? I'm looking to see longevity of teachers. How long are teachers sticking around in this district? Because if teachers are staying, that means that they are happy there. That means that their pay is probably pretty decent. It means they are able to feel professional and successful there. So you're looking for low teacher turnover, but you're also looking for a high rate of new teachers coming to the district. Because if you're getting a lot of those first year college grads applying, that means that the district is doing something right and they're attracting new talent in addition to the veteran teachers that are there. Also looking at the standards of learning or the state testing scores, you're looking for at your child's grade level, elementary, middle, or high, you should be looking to see what percentage of kids are passing this at the proficient level or higher. And so that's what the score is. So if you see like in ACPS, they'll tell you in Alexandria City Public Schools, they'll be like, oh, 50% of the students in fourth grade pass the math test at the proficient level or higher. And so that tells you that about half the students were able to successfully show mastery of the fourth grade math content. So you should look at that. Some places you should also consider the ranking websites, but not as strongly as the school report cards. And then reach out to parents, contact the PTA, say, we're looking at moving here. What would you say about if you could do it over again, would you move here with your child?
It's a great question. I usually would say, what would you tell your sister to do?
Right.
And then I say, assuming you have a sister and you love her.
Yeah.
But just asking those questions and doing the research. So back to the IEP, do goals or directives in an IEP ever get lost in translation, meaning from state to state or county to county when it gets moved?
Yes. So because there's that keyword comparable written into IDEA, and there's also a secondary law called the Military Child Education Compact, the Military Interstate MIC3, basically, MIC3, Military Interstate Child Compact Coalition. It basically is a backstop to all of the federal laws that require 504 plans and IEPs, but also MIC3 also encompasses gifted education and general education. It helps children in military situations have more continuity. So in any event, yes, it can, because of the word comparable. So comparable just requires a close match. So are our glasses comparable? We're both wearing glasses. Yes, they both have lenses. Yes, they both help us see better. However, they are very different shapes. They are different patterns. I think mine are all the way tortoise shell. Yours are only half tortoise shell. Mine have metal on the sides. It looks like yours maybe have plastic on the sides, and they're very different styles. However, they are comparable. We both have access to glasses.
But my glasses may not work for you, and vice versa.
Correct. We both have microphones. I have an AirPod and you have your fancy podcast recording mic. They are comparable. I can hear you and you can hear me and they're picking up sound, but they're not the same. They're not identical. And so the comparable means that they have to provide about the same services. So I'll give you an example of speech. What this could mean is, let's say your child is getting speech 3 times a week for 15 minutes each time, right? That's their baseline. When they move to a new school, that could change to 1 45-minute session, or it could change to 1 30-minute session. Or 2 20-minute sessions, it could say 3 15-minute sessions, or it could say, you know, it usually goes down and not up. But all of those ideas, all of those different session and timing options are still comparable. Is your child receiving speech? Yes, they are. Are they still receiving it for within, let's say, 20 minutes worth of 45 minutes per week? They sure are. But it doesn't specify program, it doesn't specify content, it doesn't specify duration or frequency, it just is similar. And so the services is kind of where we see the breakdown. The other breakdown we see is in accommodations. So a line that I've heard a lot lately, or in the last several years, is, well, that's best practice. And yes, that's the face I make also. It's
people can't see me. I know.
it's a raised eyebrow and a pursed lip. And so my line is, well, I'm really excited that your teachers are doing this. And you're right, it is best practice, but let's pretend they're going to a place where teachers are not as well versed in what a responsive classroom looks like for a child with autism or a child with dyslexia. Great, I'm really excited that you're moving all of their stuff into the special dyslexic font. But what if the next school doesn't follow that guideline and this child is moving? Let's pretend that that's happening and put it in writing. Because best practice, while it should be universal, is not universal.
Right.
And so, and best practice is interpreted differently based on socioeconomic and cultural norms of that school.
So then how do you guide parents to mitigate this?
Everything that is different than the standard curriculum needs to be put in writing.
So
everything.
If it's put in writing, they will receive it or no?
They should receive at least comparable services. So if it says that your child needs to have structured breaks throughout the school day, they need to have structured breaks throughout the school day. Now, in practice, what that looks like might be different based on the classroom teacher, based on the case manager, based on the school, based on the physical building, based on the staffing options, and what the classroom physically looks like. It could be, you know, they have a beanbag in the back. That's their break space. It could be that there's a really great OT on staff that has an assistant who is able to come and do some heavy work with that child, and that's the structured break. And so it will look different. And if you want your child to get a specific thing, then you need to be very clear in the wording. So if you need a heavy work break, then you need to say this child needs to have at least 4 5-minute periods throughout the evenly spaced throughout the school day to do heavy work, parentheses, examples of, but not inclusive, include stop, squats, wall push-ups, climbing up and down the stairs, doing giant steps, doing medicine ball slams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so being hyper specific, not to the point of inflexibility or not being able to add anything, but setting the baseline of this is the minimum that is required.
Have you ever heard of Karen, the IEP boss?
No.
She calls it prescriptive and puffy. So your present levels should be prescriptive and puffy. Mm-hmm. And so as you were describing that, being very specific and clear in the IEP, which is a great practice for students, regardless if they are anticipating a move or not anticipating a move. So it's very clear when they go from grade to grade, or if that student is transitioning from one school building to the next.
Yes. And grade levels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How does this work for overseas? If I'm a military family and I'm stateside and now I'm moving overseas, how does the federal law get interpreted?
So in writing, it's the Department of Defense Education Action, or Department of Defense Dependent Schools, it's DODS and DODEA. They are the school division responsible for providing military children with their education services overseas. For military children who meet eligibility and criteria, they operate as the public school. DOD memo 1342.12 specifies that DODEA schools will follow IDEA in all aspects. However, as you and I both know, and probably your listeners also know, IDEA is a little bit loosey-goosey with language and timelines and is not hyper-specific in how things should go. They use the word reasonable a lot. They use best practice a lot. So it can be special. The other tricky thing is that there are overseas DODEA schools and there are stateside DODEA schools. Every DODEA school, every Department of Defense school has a disability rating in multiple categories. So they have a multi-tiered rating system. I think right now it's 3 levels or maybe 4. I haven't looked recently. And it graduates in severity. So you cannot, in theory, be assigned to a location that has a mismatch between your child's EFMP, the Exceptional Family Members Program rating, and the DODEA school rating for that IDEA eligibility category. In practice, mismatches happen all the time. And the other issue is that, much like everywhere else in America, DODEA is having some staffing challenges, not holistically, but it takes, because it's a federal government job, anyone who has ever applied for a federal government job and not had to do a boot camp thing to get there, it takes a while to get onboarded. It's a process. It's a marathon and not a sprint. You know, if you're applying for a public school job in America, in a regular public school, you could be interviewed on Tuesday, get your contract on Friday, and you're in the classroom on Monday, friend. Like, you better be ready to go. In DODEA schools, you have to put your resume into a system. USA Jobs, there's a DODEA, USA Jobs is like the federal warehouse for all federal jobs. DODEA has their own. So you have to put your resume in there. You specify, you have to upload it, and then they check it. And then you have to select where you want to work. So you can work stateside, CONUS, continental United States, or OCONUS, outside of the continental United States. Then within that, you have to select, do you want to work Europe or Asia? Those are where the hubs are. And then you can select specific schools. Then you wait for an opening to come up that matches your profile and preferences for location. Then the principal contacts you, then you have an interview, then you get the job offer, but it's not official. It's just like a, hey, we're thinking of offering you this job. We'd like you to join our staff, submit all this paperwork. And then 3 months later, you will be cleared by the background security people and you will be in the classroom. 3 month lag time is typical for substituting jobs too. Mm-hmm. And then in some places you can't work there because they have hiring practices. Military spouses are what's called usually local hires, meaning you're already physically in place. That's how I was hired to work in Okinawa, Japan. I was a local hire. And there's differences between like a system hire and a local hire, which is a topic for a different podcast. But basically there's positions that are filled that are still open because the teacher hasn't been cleared yet in Dodea. Sorry, that was a long tangent. I have feelings, obviously.
Yeah. I can see why. I mean, it's a lot. So what are some techniques you've seen used to streamline referrals and goals when you're transferring from base to base in regards to the need for special education support?
Absolutely. So I always like to, for my clients, I build an online repository of all of their things organized by type. So IEPs, one folder, and then data in another folder. That way I can pick and choose and build a profile to send to the receiving school and like package it really neatly in one PDF. That way the family can send it out and say, hey, we're coming. Here's our kid. This is what you need to know day one to service this child appropriately. Here's our advocate's name and number. Here's our number. Here's our doctor's number. Here are all the people that you can contact to talk to about this child. That's the first step, is to prep. Do the advanced landing prep of we're coming, here's what you need to know. The second step is as soon as you arrive, whether that's during the summer months or mid-school year, you contact the main office of the school immediately and you set up a meeting and say, we are here. We need to meet with X, Y, and Z, special ed, 504 coordinator, gifted program, grade level team coordinator, the counselor at the middle school and high school. I need all the people in the room because I need to give you the rundown on my kid. So that's kind of the advance prep. And then it's going through the transition. So usually when you transfer with an IEP, the receiving school district should take it and they might translate it into their own form. Many schools have their own like transfer IEP form and they just populate it with that and they put it in place for however many days they need to have it for their state laws. Go through that with a fine tooth comb, because a lot of my clients have found that services were not correctly input. So especially with one-on-one aides, or if there are other medical concerns, like they have an allergies with an EpiPen, or they need to take meds certain times throughout the day, sometimes those are missed or not always accurately transcribed because the systems in each state are different. Of course they are. And so, you know, going through that and then scheduling another meeting and saying, okay, now we need to make the real IEP for this district. Let's negotiate. And just remembering, you know, your kid needs what they need. They don't need to be put in a box. There's an I and IEP for a reason, and they need what their data indicates they need.
How can parents be better informed of their rights? How can they be better informed to know if a violation took place or what that would look like when the receiving school did the transfer of the data and the information from the initial starting point of that IEP that was transferred in?
I like to do a point by point comparison between the two documents. There is, unfortunately, no easy answer. It's going to take time. It's going to take dedication. It's going to take an insightful eye. So point by point comparisons of in district A, they had X. Can I find that in district B? Do they have that in there? Yes or no? And then I like to go through, I have the CAMI extension on my browser. And so I will pull up both IEPs side by side and I'll go through with like, they have red, yellow, green, a highlighting tool. And if I don't see it in there, it's red. If it's in there, but it's substantially different, it's yellow. And if it's like a match, then it's green. That way I can go back to the parents and the district and say, now what happened to these red and yellow things? Where are they? How are they being implemented? You missed this. If you do find a violation, it's important that you look back at your procedural guidelines. That is the Bible of special education rights for parents. It outlines everything that you should be getting, things like translations of documents, accessible formats. If you want to have a meeting recorded because you have a processing disorder or for whatever, you know, and it outlines all of the steps you need to take in your state to contest something that is wrong, to go through the mediation process, the facilitated IEP process, to go through due process, which is the legal process. Lots of process today, but it outlines everything. So going through point by point and then referencing your procedural guidelines, and then coming back to the school and just, you know, professionally pointing out, hey, I think you missed this, and seeing what their reaction is.
What can parents do if they're not getting communication from one or both school systems? Because oftentimes and I think you had mentioned this as well, that if a student is moving from one state or district to another, the receiving district can reach out to the initial district to have a conversation, maybe touch base with the teacher and say, you know, I'm reading this document. What does this student really look like? So is there any tips that you give to parents to help improve that communication?
Absolutely. So I like to have parents, especially for older children, I recommend that they talk, actually really all children, they talk to their child's current teacher or teachers and ask if they could write up a brief anecdotal report of like, what does this child look like in your classroom on a day-to-day basis? Like, what do they need? Do they need to be sitting in a certain place? What kind of students do they work with well? What kind of academic modifications are you doing for them on a regular basis? And these anecdotal reports should mirror the present levels and the accommodations, modifications, and IEP goals. And if they don't, then you need to be asking why. When you get to the new school, I think it's important that those anecdotal reports be put into the present levels, because yes, it's going to make it wordy. Yes, is it going to be a book? 100%. But if I'm a new teacher and I teach math and I know this child is new, then I can go to present level and say, oh gosh, this is what their math teacher in Massachusetts was doing. This is what their math class looked like. And now I have a model to start from, as opposed to a blank slate of I have a kid. I know they have ADHD. I know they have dyscalculia. What does this look like? Because it can present in a myriad of different ways. But if I have the blueprint, I can go back and say, oh, okay, they just need it big. They need it in the squiggly font. They need it on a pink piece of paper. They need to have a highlighter. They need to have this. And I can easily put those in place day one, as opposed to not having anything at all. The other thing is I always like to have an unofficial record. So to transfer, the school should talk to each other. And that's how the official record gets transferred, with all of their documents and data and testing and all of that stuff. However, when I register, I always like to recommend that schools accept and parents provide the unofficial physical record or digital record of their child from the last school district. I travel with my child's if I'm moving potentially this summer, I'm going to have all their records from their current public school with me in a physical format, because I need to be able on day one to say, this is my child. This is what they've done for the last 5 years in Northern Virginia. Hello, California. This is my kid.
Parents often, you know, just don't know what to ask or say. How would you empower parents to be stronger advocates and feel confident in questioning things?
So if you think about it like a doctor's office, if you go to a doctor for a rash and they prescribe you a cream, you're going to say, why? What will this cream do? What will it look like? And how long should it take to fix this rash that I have? IEP meetings are not any different. They're offering you a program to support your child's education. And so the most important question you can ask is why? Why is this the recommendation? The next important question is how? How does this look? And then last is who? Who is going to be providing this program of education for my child? What are their credentials? What is their experience? Have they ever worked with a child like mine before? And so you should be getting satisfactory answers of, well, why are we doing this? Well, because OG is a research-based intervention for children with dyslexia. The person who is providing this is, you know, she's OG certified, level whatever. She's been doing this for 15 years. And the program you're going to be using is this particular is Barton, and it's OG based, and this is how it rolls out. And so now you have a complete picture of what your child, what the prescription is for your child at school. But it can be really hard to ask those questions. So sometimes I like to bring a, well, actually not sometimes, all the time. I like to bring a checklist, and I will give it to parents. I'll type it up for parents before the meeting, and it's bullet pointed and different colors of highlighter and fonts and bold and italics. That way they have a script of what to ask for and what to look for at the school during the meeting. I find it helps parents because they know that I've prepared it for them. So they have an expert who's preparing it for them, and they literally just read from the script, and that's it. And it's personalized to their child.
That's empowering. How do we positively communicate a complaint? How can we tell if we're being kind of too nice, so to say?
Mm-hmm. So I always like to, I call it polite but professional, and then I sandwich it. So I'll start off with, "Hi, Ms. Taylor, I really appreciate the art project that you're doing with little Johnny. I love seeing his creative side. However, I have a concern that, you know, he's not making friends at recess. And so I would really love your insights about how he is socializing in school. Thank you for partnering with me. Sincerely, Meg." And so now you feel good because I've recognized something good that you're doing in the classroom that my child is responding to. I've brought you a concern, I've explained what feedback I want, and then I've closed by bringing you onto my team as my partner. And obviously, you know, that's a softball situation, you know, he's just not making friends. Great. But for something more serious, I think keeping it brief and to the point is, "Johnny has missed his counseling sessions or has reported missing his counseling sessions for the last 3 weeks, Ms. Taylor. I would love to see some documentation about why he has missed these counseling sessions and how we plan on compensating for that. Thank you for partnering with me." So I'm calling you out, but I'm asking you to provide some evidence. And so hopefully you would be able to come back and say, "Gosh, I'm really sorry. I tested positive for COVID. So I was out the first week. And then the second week, there was a field trip and a concert, and they were having a presentation from fifth grade. I am so sorry. I'm going to make sure to pull him for a longer period of time for the next 5 weeks in order to make up for that." And I think that's a reasonable response. You gave me a reason and you've told me how you're going to fix it.
Yeah. What is the perfect IEP environment in your opinion? And what does a successful and student-centered team have?
So I'm going to start with, what do they have? So a successful student-centered team has a level playing field. And what I mean by that is that everyone is given due respect. So if I'm calling you Miss Taylor and you're the school, you don't call me mom. You call me Meg or you call me Miss Flanagan. I'm not mom. I am a member of this team and you need to know my name. So if school teams would stop calling the child's grown-ups mom and dad or whatever their special title is, call them by their name, because it shows that now I am on an equal playing field with you. We both have the language of respect. Because when you call someone mom or dad, it means that they're a guest at the table and you are not respecting them enough to learn their name. Give them that respect. The second thing it needs is full and complete transparency. That means that if you have an educational record pertaining to a child, it needs to be shared. If it's something that you've kept in your notes that are your personal private notes, that's one thing. If it's like, "Oh, I noticed that, you know, he doesn't like blue lollipops, so I'm going to make sure to get green ones." Great. That's a note that's just for you. But if you're using that note to make the IEP or report progress, then you'd better be sharing that information with me. Even if you have to redact other children's information, that's my educational record now, or my child's educational record. So respect and transparency are the two things you need to have a successful IEP meeting, because everything flows from there. You're more likely to have a frank conversation when everyone is feeling respected and no one is feeling attacked. So that's a lot of times what I see is that parents feel like they're coming out flat-footed because they don't know what's being talked about. And that only comes from transparency, from having, this is your child's educational record, here is what it means, in very clear, simple, plain language. A successful IEP meeting to me looks like considering all of the options available and truly considering them, not just saying, oh, well, we know that he doesn't need to go to a special school. No, explain to me why a private placement is not a good fit for my child. And explain it to me every single time. At this time, we have found that, you know, Sam doesn't need to go to a private placement school because we can see on his IEP that he is making sufficient, he is making a good trajectory of progress on these IEP goals in this public school setting at this time. We will consider this again next time. Explaining it very clearly. Once everything is explained, then parents can talk, can speak up and say, well, I don't agree with that. Or, you know, can we have another look? What are some other options that are available to them?
As we kind of wind down, what did I not know enough to ask that I should have asked?
So I think one of the important things to remember about military kids is that not only are they highly mobile, but America has been at war, and yes, we're technically not at war anymore, but we've been at war consistently since 2001. And so we are at the tail end right now of the 9/11 baby generation. So most of the kids that were born in 2000, like right immediately after everything started, they're now in college or entering adulthood. However, we still have a large population of military children who have lived through multiple combat deployments. They have kissed their parent goodbye and not known if they were going to come back or not. And so military children have a lot of trauma, hidden trauma. So I'll give an example from my life. My kids were born after my husband's most recent deployment. They have never known a world where their dad has deployed to a combat zone. He's gone on work trips. He's gone on, you know, shorts, and by short, I mean less than 6 months, but they still know that he's in the military. And so we went to the Marine Corps Museum, which is a fabulous museum in Quantico, Virginia. And we went to, and I thought nothing of it because I was a teenager when 9/11 happened. And so it's just part of my growing up. So we went there and we walked past the 9/11 exhibit. There's a big picture of the Pentagon with the side missing. And my husband worked there at the time. And they had this visceral response of, that's where dad works. Oh my God, it got blown up. Could that happen again? And they were terrified of him going to work for 6 months at least. And they still talk about it. Dad, do you remember when the plane flew into your building? Do you remember? And he's like, no, I don't remember. I wasn't there. But they have a trauma response to that. They have been in locations where people have died during training accidents. And so they have that internalized trauma response. And so when you have a population of military children, whether they are typically developing or not, these children and their parents have a level of trauma that is not always apparent to non-military families, to non-military people. So being very, very careful about how you address world conflict, being very careful about how you address holidays like Memorial Day or Veterans Day is a 9/11 is essential. It's something that is hard. It's a hard holiday. Those are hard holidays for military families because you're remembering people that you knew.
I appreciate that perspective. And so how would teachers recognize or better support, or how can they find resources to learn further about the hidden traumas that are within military families or families that move often?
So one great resource is MCEC, the Military Child Education Coalition. They are a nationwide resource for all school teachers, for families. They offer educator trainings and school admin trainings about how to serve military children. They offer them, you know, multiple times a year. They have recordings available. If you are in a community where there is a military base, you can reach out to the school liaison officer there as a school member, as a school employee, and say, hi, I'm looking for resources for. There's also In many public schools, in military communities, and in DODEA schools, there's a program called Military Family Life Counselors, and they will station a specialized counselor at your school to help military children. You can also, there's tons of books, usually at like picture book level, like Dr. Jill Biden wrote one for military kids, I think for her grandkids. There's ways to make it personal. If you are in a military community, or you know that there's a veteran community there with school-aged children, sending an email and saying, hi, we are going to be doing a Memorial Day project. Is there anything I need to know to protect your child, or that you don't want your child to participate in? For Veterans Day, sending out an email and saying, we would love to learn more about your military service. If you are a service member, you know, and want to come in and be a guest reader, let me know. I know my husband and his colleagues before we had kids would come in all the time to my classrooms and read and be like the Veterans Day guest reader. And it was the cutest thing. The kids loved it, and they loved it because they got to be public facing for a minute. They got to, you know, explain a little bit about what it's like to be in the military. And I think that if we can bridge that not a divide, but a gap. If we can bridge the gap between what people think they know about military life and what military life actually is, I think that's really important. So anytime you have a chance to connect with a SLO, with EFMP, with the Military Family Life Counselors, with military families, with veterans organizations, it's really important.
What are three tips that you would give professionals to act upon?
Be rigorous with data collection and documentation. So that's tip one. Have a system and know it. For your data collection and documentation, it's the same tip. Tip two would be leave the building at your contracted time. Go home. Please relax. You're doing the absolute most. I know no one expects you to be perfect. We just expect you to be professional and do your job to the best of your ability at this time, given the restrictions and circumstances. Tip three would be kind to yourself, be kind to your students. Be kind to your colleagues and be kind to the grown-ups of your students. Everyone deserves just a little bit of kindness and grace in our crazy mixed up world.
And conversely, what would you give tips for parents, especially if they're preparing for a move, a military parent or family?
I would say pause and dwell in whatever emotions you have right now. I know that not every move is going to be positive or welcomed, but there is always a silver lining somewhere. And so if you can just slow down and think about it for however long you need, I mean, obviously not like 6 months, but like maybe like a week, and not do anything other than just get used to the idea of moving. That's a great thing to do. And the second one would be to prepare to contact the school that you're currently at. Let them know, hey, we're moving. I'd like to have, you know, PDF copies of everything you have on file. I'm happy to come in and scan them myself or make copies myself, but I just need this file. And the third thing would be to listen to your children. As a parent, I know that moves for me are traumatic. It's a big change. I'm very type A. I like to be in one place. I don't like changes. They're also traumatic for your children. And so while I'm doing my checks in the box of what I need to do to get my kids ready to move, they're processing their own emotions. And so sometimes I just need to remind myself to pause and listen. And, you know, take a little bit of time to explain or give a hug and some reassurances to make them feel secure that even if we're moving, it doesn't change our family. It doesn't change who they are as a person. It just changes our physical location and we can regroup and recover.
This has been phenomenal. And I hope families or professionals that are listening can take this in, take the advice, and either be educated on and being aware of military families, or if you are a military family, being supported and guided up to some treasures that you can put into place to help make things a little bit easier. Meg, how can people find you, your educational solutions? We didn't mention your book. So all of those things as we wind down, can you let people know about that?
Absolutely. So I wrote a book. It's called Talk to the Teacher, and it is a recipe book of scripts and emails and conversations to have with your child's teachers in a wide variety of situations, everything from a parent-teacher conference to handling a child's negative behavior at school. including and up to suspension and expulsion. It includes all sorts of those document tracking forms. I have forms in there to do the document and data tracking, like I talked about earlier, looking for those red flags. There are make yourself templates. You can get that on Amazon. It's called Talk to the Teacher. You can also get it on my website, megflanagan.com. And then that's my handle for all of the social medias is if you just search Meg Flanagan, Education Advocate, I should pop up pretty easily.
Fantastic. I am grateful for your time. I hope people are going onto your website or where they purchase their books and get a copy of their book and to reach out to you if they need more support. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Thank you again for listening and taking some time. I want you guys to think about my strategy takeaways would be documenting data, ensuring you're getting anecdotal reports from the teachers that are supporting your child. If you're a family getting ready to move, knowing that it is going to take a while to receive special education services. So if you are struggling, if you are concerned, if you are overwhelmed, reach out and figure out what that timeline looks like. Realistically, you're looking at 3 to 4 months in order to get that strategic specialized instruction. So thank you again for strategizing with me and spending your precious time listening. If you've loved what you've heard, give us a like and follow at Learning Essentials. If you are uncertain about that IEP process and you need a simple way to strategize, we have a course that is available to help guide parents through those 6 steps to make that process easier. If you need more special education support, also visit us, learningessentialsedu.com, where we provide individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching, educational therapy, and Brain Camp, our executive function model. Bye for now.